You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
We need to hold our governments accountable to ensure that they don't have double standards and that they're not prioritizing their economic interests over the interests of human rights, environmental rights, labor rights, and the rights of all of us around the world.
That's the voice of Raul Borbano from Common Frontiers. On this week's show, we speak to Raul about the illegal and ongoing coup attempt in Venezuela.
I'm very privileged this morning to be joined by Raul Borbano. He is the Project Director of Common Frontiers. Thank you for joining us this morning, Raul.
Thank you for having me, Sylvia. It's a pleasure.
Now, we are witnessing not an unprecedented event, but very alarming event, as the government of Canada has been upholding the declaration of President Trump's of Juan Guaido as the president of Venezuela. Can we talk a little bit about the significance of this declaration and what it means in terms of democratic process?
Well, Juan Guaido, who's a relatively unknown politician and currently head of the National Assembly, has, you know, last week self-proclaimed himself as, you know, interim president of Venezuela. And immediately following that, the United States, Trump, and Christopher Lin, representing Canada, have recognized him as the legitimate president or expressing support for him, which clearly is unprecedented in terms of any basic democratic norms. It's a complete anti-democratic move. It's against the constitution of Venezuela to begin with. It's against any, you know, international norms. So really what it's doing is Canada and the United States, by recognizing this individual as the interim legitimate president, who, again, wasn't elected, doesn't have a mandate from the people of Venezuela. His only mandate comes from external support, as I mentioned. What it's trying to do is create, in essence, a major confrontation that could escalate into a civil war in the country, because obviously the Chavistas, which are supporters of Maduro, who last year in May of 2018, undertook presidential elections. Maduro and the PSUV won for a second term, and he was just inaugurated the week before, I believe, as well. And so, you know, 8 million Chavistas who voted for Nicolas Maduro now obviously are going to be in conflict with the supporters of Guaido, who, again, are backed and funded by the United States.
Now, for Latin Americans, this practice is not unfamiliar. We witnessed that in Honduras only in 2008 when Manuel Zelaya was, you know, usurped from power. Can you talk a little bit about what the process was? You were one of the observers at the presidential elections of Maduro.
Yes, I was. So, you know, I led a delegation of labor and ecumenical organizations from Canada that participated in the elections of President Maduro. Ourselves, along with about 150 international observers, you know, came up with reports. You can see our in-depth report on the Common Frontiers website about the elections in Venezuela, where we document the process, the climate, you know, the political parties, and you get a sense that clearly Venezuela has a very strong democratic participatory electoral system that is considered one of the best in the world, according to experts around the world who study elections. For example, the Carter Institute, you know, referenced Venezuela's system as one of the best elections in the electoral systems in the world. So I think what's happening here, the narrative that in Venezuela that there is a humanitarian crisis, and I will preface that with that there are challenges in Venezuela economically. There's obviously a political challenges, so one cannot discount that there are serious economic issues in Venezuela that need to be resolved, but there are many factors that impact the economic situation that, of course, is causing people to, for example, leave Venezuela at this point. In the mainstream media and in general, those who look to topple the government only focus on certain aspects, i.e. that it's a dictatorship, and that Maduro and, in essence, socialism, because that's really how it's always pegged. It's always Maduro and socialism. Maduro and the Pink Time countries have destroyed the economy, and hence we need to save the people of Venezuela. I think it's important to point out that the majority of Venezuelans reject this. He's not recognized by anybody in Venezuela outside of the opposition circle, which tends to be a relatively small group. The opposition in Venezuela obviously is broad in terms of different groups, but the group who has, you know, crowned Juan Guaido as the interim president tend to be the extremist group. They tend to be violent when they undertake protests, and their main goal has been from the very beginning, and they state this openly. So this is not, you know, this is not a secret that their main goal is to topple the government. Their main goal is not to better the economy. Their goal is not to try to, you know, improve the situation, but rather to seek intervention by external forces in the international community to overthrow a democratically elected government. And I think in any part of the world, one doesn't have to be, for example, a constitutional expert to know that no individual can just auto-proclaim themselves as president of a country. If it didn't have such human implications, i.e. potential for violence and war in a country, it would actually be funny. We would all be laughing at this. And I think the internet has sort of made a mockery of this. Right now, everybody's pronouncing themselves, you know, prime minister, president of any country that they want. I know, for example, here in Toronto, as an anecdote, OCAP, Fight Against Poverty, have said they're going to call a meeting to, appoint an interim new mayor. I mean, this is just, you know, these are the type of jokes that are going around because it is so absurd. But the reality is, unfortunately, this is happening, and it has a very serious and human consequence to the people in Venezuela.
You know, one of the things that are being used as an excuse is the low turnout at the elections. How can we compare that to the kinds of turnouts we get here in Canada and the legitimacy that is being given in terms of the intervention being based on this?
I think people are always looking for reasons to try to discredit the electoral process in Venezuela. But, you know, there's a couple of things we should keep in mind. So in Venezuela, some opposition members, not all, but part of the opposition, decided that they would boycott the elections, which obviously is their choice. Even though the opposition were the ones who were calling for elections, once the United States told them not to participate in elections, they chose not to. So again, part of the opposition, you know, three parties, a small subset, decided not to participate. Their goal and their message to their base was do not vote, do not participate in the electoral process as a way to delegitimize it. So that's one thing. The opposition who was also, you know, it was a, they were threatening people who would vote within the areas in which they controlled. So, for example, you know, in some areas, polls had troubles opening. Again, in the areas where they were controlled by the opposition or where the opposition has influence. Altamira and those kind of places where there is tends to be a cluster of opposition members, you know, the, some of the polls had to be moved in order to accommodate. They were open late. All those type of reasons influence voter turnout. Not to mention, for example, in Canada, the Canadian government forbade Venezuelans to vote in the election. So if you were in Canada and you were a Canadian Venezuelan and you wanted to go vote, you weren't allowed to because Canada did not allow people to vote. Again, all part of a larger process to try to make the election seem illegitimate. So yes, obviously that had a, you know, an impact on the voter turnout. Voter turnout in Venezuela was almost 50%, it was 48%. So it's not that bad, and it's much better than in many other countries. However, we do have to acknowledge that it was lower than it was traditionally for Venezuela, because Venezuelans in general have been participating in the electoral process 23 times in the last 19, 20 years. So people do participate quite a lot. But I do think also the difficult economic situation and often what people feel, you know, the lack of responses from both the government and the opposition in terms of meeting the real needs of the people are starting to, you know, have an influence. And yes, there was a bit of a, you know, there was a lower turnout than is usual. But again, that would not in any way disqualify the elections or make them illegitimate, because if that's the case, then any presidents around the world wouldn't be presidents.
You know, it's interesting that we are talking about this as the government of Canada sent military troops into indigenous territory that is unceded. And when we talk about the violence, the tyranny of one government against its own people, we have ample examples among ourselves in our own country to be mediating and to be interfering and this, you know, dispossessing other people, their own governments. So can we talk a little bit about why Venezuela? Why is the President Trump intent on removing Maduro from power? Why this obsession with creating a coup in Venezuela?
Probably a few reasons why the U.S. has been trying for 20 years now, since the election of Hugo Chavez in 1998. The United States has, said from and you can find it online, from, unclassified WikiLeaks documents, from actual statements from, from the Obama to Trump, is Venezuela first is geostrategically extremely important. It has an immense wealth of natural resources. It has the largest oil reserves in the world. It has large reserves of oil, gold, coal, and silver. So it has a plethora of natural resources that that international corporations from the U.S., for example, want to get their hands on. Under the Bolivarian revolution, for example, under Hugo Chavez, and now the caretaker of that role, which is Maduro, who's following the same line as Hugo Chavez, they have gravitated more towards Russia and China in terms of investment. So there's a lot of investment from those countries in the resource sector. And of course, for the United States, that's seen as geopolitically unacceptable. I think, the other important impact is that we have to keep in mind that, when Hugo Chavez was elected and the Bolivarian process has been going, it had sort of created an awakening for people in Latin America. And it gave rise to the pink tide, which is a lot of leftist governments started to become elected over the last 20 years. Obviously, that trend has changed, but that's what it was in the past. And we've seen that those countries were extremely anti-imperialist. They closed U.S. bases in their countries. For example, in Ecuador, they closed U.S. bases, in Venezuela, in Bolivia. Again, pink tide countries. Most of these countries focused on the nationalization of their natural resources, taking control of their natural resources, and ensuring that multinational corporations from the U.S., if they were going to participate in extractions or anything, they would ensure that the majority of the revenue would stay in the country to benefit the people, which is very different from what past Venezuelan governments had done. Most of the natural resources and the wealth of Venezuela went back to the north as opposed to staying locally. That's why the people, Venezuela, as an example, had lived in massive poverty. When Hugo Chavez took power, he basically took over the national resources and started investing in education. That's why you have free education in Venezuela. In healthcare, you have free healthcare in Venezuela. In Venezuela today, even under the tough economic conditions, they've given 2.5 million houses to the poor. So these type of policies go against everything that the United States and its allies like Canada want to impose around the world, which is a corporate capitalist system of profit for corporations at the expense of the environment, at the expense of human rights, at the expense of indigenous rights. All those things take a back step to corporate rights. And Hugo Chavez, under the Bolivarian process, revolution, and Maduro, who is now following in that mantle, sort of led that process in Latin America, being an inspiration for many countries. And I think the United States wants to punish Venezuela for daring to dream that they can actually, have an alternative model that, meets their needs and aren't willing to follow the lead of the U.S. So I think it's a punishment to the people of Venezuela for daring to challenge indirectly the economic model that the U.S. has imposed globally. And second, to get a hold of the strategic resources, which are very important at this point for industrialization and the continued development of, the mega projects around the world, especially that are led by U.S. corporations.
Now, for many of us, there are urgent needs that we need to focus on in our own countries. Here in Canada, for instance, indigenous rights are being trampled. We saw the abuse that, military officers have exerted in indigenous territory that is unceded to force a pipeline, through British Columbia. What are the implications of allowing this kind of interference in Latin America and stopping the Bolivarian people from having a country that is, a democracy that is for the people, by the people, and a government that honors that?
I think what it tells us is that although the Canadian government professes to support human rights, Indigenous rights, really cares about environmental rights, often that is more window dressing than reality, because, as you said, we see the policies that are implemented. For example, we just went through a process of reconciliation in Canada, and yet, as you mentioned, the RCMP violently stormed the Unist'ot'en camp and is trying and is forcing the people of that region to allow a corporation for pipeline development, violating the rights of the Indigenous people in this country in terms of consultation, real consultation. So I think what it tells us is that, you know, the Canadian state has interest that it would put before anything in Canada and abroad. So when we see Canada talking about human rights and democracy in Venezuela, I think we have to take that with a grain of salt and look more deeply as what is the real interest and why is Canada so adamantly supporting an opposition in Venezuela that in many instances have engaged in violence. If the opposition, if any opposition in Canada engaged in the type of violence that the opposition in Venezuela has done, they would be immediately incarcerated in Canada. No doubt about that. So I think there is a duplicity in terms of Canada's speech, in terms of human rights, democracy, respect for Indigenous people. And on the other hand, what we see is Canada, you know, unquestionably supporting our corporations at the expense of Indigenous rights, at the expense of human rights, and at the expense of the environment. And I think that's what, as Canadians and people who live in this territory, should be concerned about. And we should hold our government accountable when they violate any of those principles in Canada and abroad.
The lesson that Venezuelans have taught us is that despite having a military coup in 2002, the people came in support of their choice of government. And I feel that at this point, the lesson we are learning is that the governments who are pro-corporate are united. They seem to have a concerted effort to bring down this government. So how do we, the people, mobilize? How do we create a vision, co-create a vision of society that is not pro-imperial power, that is not a continuation of colonization, that is not a continuation of might is right, and, you know, that has been the motto that has been enforced throughout the last century?
Mm-hmm. You know, you're right in terms of that, you know, Canada has undertaken a very interesting role in terms of supporting certain countries and certain governments who follow a very particular line that benefits corporations and Canadians' economic interests. Just as an example, Canada is leading the Lima Group, or as I call it, the Lima Cartel, but the Lima Group of countries who are taking the charge to try to bring, quote unquote, democracy and stability to Venezuela. If we take a look at who's in that coalition with Canada, it gives us a good example of the partners that Canada works very closely internationally to undertake these things. For example, as you mentioned, Honduras is one of the leading partners in the Lima Cartel, probably Latin America's most flagrant criminal regime today, with a coup d'etat in 2009 that overthrew the democratically elected government. It has political prisoners. We know of political prisoners in Honduras, Edwin Espinal, whose partner, wife is Karen Spring, who lives here in Canada and is a very well-known human rights activist. The murder of Indigenous campesina leader Berta Cáceres. This is the type of government that Canada is aligning with. As well, Guatemala is part of the Lima Cartel, a government so permeated by organized crime that it's unprecedented. You know, they tried to expel the UN investigation team that has revealed vast organized crime between the government of Guatemala and organized crime. And this is what, you know, the country, the President Jimmy Morales has basically run roughshod over Guatemala. And yet this is one of Canadians' partners in trying to bring democracy to Venezuela. We have Brazil as another perfect example. Brazil under Bolsonaro, who was elected, you know, last year, he's come up pretty clearly. He's nostalgic for the dictatorships of Brazil. And he has said he's willing to, you know, wipe clean Brazil of any kind of leftist, you know, socialist, whatever, activist. His main issue with the, you know, regimes and dictatorships of Brazil in the past is he said they didn't kill enough people. This is the type of leader that is today with Canada, hand in hand, to bring democracy to Venezuela. It's so bad in Brazil today that one of the senators in Brazil, I think his name is Gene Wiles, a congressman who's an open LGBT man, has left his post. He has abandoned his post and left Brazil because of fear that he will be persecuted under the Brazil government. As people who live in Canada and who are international, we need to recognize and build links between the struggles of people in the global south and in the north, and to say we need to stand up against, you know, corporate impunity. We need to hold our governments accountable whenever they, you know, they don't do the things that they're supposed to do or that they commit to do. And we need to build a movement that really respects, you know, ourselves, the environment, the indigenous territories that we live on, and the principles that we really should be living around that I think most people understand and want to live by in a way that supports one another. It's clear that in Canada and around the world, we need to wake up in terms of the impacts we're having around the world, on the environment, on our fellow neighbors, and build and dream beyond what, you know, shopping at, you know, the local stores.
On January 26th, there were many, you know, demonstrations. People took to the streets to denounce the involvement of the Canadian government in interfering in Venezuela. How should we continue to create these bridges with our brothers and sisters in Venezuela who are defending and standing up for their right to sovereignty and to mark their own destiny?
Absolutely. So I think the best way to be in solidarity with Venezuela is to ensure that Venezuelans can determine the outcome of anything in their country themselves. You know, to advocate for a peaceful negotiated settlement in Venezuela is a key component, because that's what the majority of Venezuelans want. They want peace. They want to improve their economy. They want to improve the situations they have there. But they can't do that if there's, you know, fear of war and intervention. Second, I think as people who live in Canada and around the world, is to hold our governments accountable to ensure that they don't try to undertake actions that are illegal, that violate international law, all under our name. So when the Canadian government says that they recognize an illegitimate coup-backed leader in Venezuela, I think we need to hold them accountable. When the Canadian government and other governments try to impose illegal unilateral sanctions against a country like Venezuela, because we know sanctions hurt people, then if we really want to help the people of Venezuela, the first thing is we should end the sanctions against Venezuela and work to help in the economy in Venezuela. So we really need to hold our government accountable to what they say. And for example, when we talk to the Canadian government and we ask them about all the, you know, the situation in Honduras and Guatemala, they say, yes, things are bad, but we need to engage. We need to support. We need to invest in those countries. That's the only way we bring around change. But yet around Venezuela, it's the opposite. It's isolation. It's create conflict. So we need to hold our governments accountable to ensure that they don't have double standards and that they're not prioritizing their economic interests over the interests of human rights, environmental rights, labor rights, and the rights of all of us around the world.
Thank you so much for being with us today. How can people learn more about your work, and how can people stay connected with you?
They can visit our website, www.commonfrontiers.ca. There we have our work on Venezuela and our work around the world in Latin America. As I mentioned, we have a delegation that went to Venezuela that has, and we've published a 30-page plus report that goes into detail about the electoral process in Venezuela. So if you're interested to find out about the electoral system in Venezuela and not be confused by the mainstream media that it was, you know, anti-democratic, you can see it there.
Thank you again.
Before we leave today, it's important to note for the record that despite much pressure from the U.S., the majority of countries that spoke at the U.N. Special Assembly meeting supported Venezuela and their right to determine their own future and spoke against the coup. Here's a short talk by a representative from St. Vincent and the Grenadines, a small Caribbean country who has the courage to stand up, unlike Canada.
Thank you very much. Excellencies, distinguished members of the Security Council, St. Vincent and the Grenadines has been monitoring very closely the recent developments in the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela at the bilateral and multilateral levels. And like many countries, we too are deeply concerned and apprehensive about the events unfolding in our neighboring Caribbean country. Let it be abundantly clear that St. Vincent and the Grenadines adheres to and upholds the fundamental principles of non-interference and non-intervention in the affairs of states. Respect for sovereignty, adherence to the rule of law, and respect for human rights and democracy as enshrined in the Charter of the United Nations. Cognizant of the complexity of the long-standing political crisis in Venezuela, exacerbated by recent events, we stress the need for meaningful dialogue among all stakeholders in the country to de-escalate the contentious and conflictive situation. Mr. President, we are undoubtedly living in an unpredictable era and must categorically reject all attempts to aggravate dangerous situations or engender change of democratically elected leaders through impositions, interventions, interferences that veer away from the basis of lasting peace and security. In the history of Latin America and the Caribbean, the imposition of the mighty against the meek is far too well known. The history of Latin America and the Caribbean is indelibly scarred by military interventions and imposition of dictator governments. That egregious history and the need to triumph over its lingering remnants drives the countries in the hemisphere to be viscerally abhorrent to any semblance of its reemergence. In our Caribbean subregion, we have witnessed the urgent fury of military intervention, and our consciousness remains aware of the uninvited and illegal interference in electioneering and electoral processes of the Cold War proxy battles. Let us not lose sight of the forest for the trees, and be mindful that the region of Latin America and the Caribbean remains a zone of peace, as proclaimed by heads of state and government of the Community of Latin America and the Caribbean States in 2014. Let Venezuela not relive the systematic act of terror and attempted coup d'etat that created bloodshed in the streets of Caracas of April 11, 2002. Mr. President, St. Vincent and the Grenadines laments the convocation of this meeting today, especially since it emerges against the backdrop of an unambiguous irony. Constitutionally, the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela has a duly elected president in the person of His Excellency Nicolas Maduro, who was officially inaugurated for his second term on January 10, 2019. Regrettably, however, an unconscionable crusade against a legally and legitimately elected president, orchestrated from within the bowels of the Organization of American States, the oldest hemispheric organization, aims to erect unilaterally and extraterritorially a parallel unelected presidential government and destabilize order and the rule of law in the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela. Presently, the OAS has abdicated its role of arbiter, and indeed, any serious leadership responsibility in the hemisphere to defuse the impasse in Venezuela, especially since it's revisiting the deplorable history of being a conduit for imperialist aggression and hegemonic ambition in Latin America and the Caribbean. Thankfully, member states within that organization have not exhausted the option of dialogue, nor have they abandoned the bedrock principles of the OAS and the United Nations Charter. Effectively, and more pointedly, Mexico and Uruguay have expressed their willingness to mediate the political crisis, whilst regional groupings such as the Caribbean Community and the European Union have offered their good offices to serve as honest brokers to facilitate dialogue among all members and resolve the crisis. St. Vincent and the Grenadines support these responsible initiatives.
We've come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an internationally syndicated weekly program made available through campus and community stations and available out to the world at www.latinwavesmedia.com.